we're surrounded by stories that just don't add up. Choices that appear to be baffling, actions that defy logic. But what if there's more to the story? On How Did It Make Sense, we explore the power of learning from experience and digging into the second stories that are always present. We talk to experts from diverse fields who are challenging the way we think about safety, risk, and decision making. Join us as we unlock the lessons hidden within everyday events. Some of these are high risk and some appear to be mundane, but all of them show how we can create a fairer, safer, and more resilient world. Welcome to another episode of How Did It Make Sense, in which we look at the deeper stories that people have following events, adverse events, or even surprises and successful outcomes. And the whole purpose of this is to be able to encourage storytelling. And if you like these stories, please leave a review or rating on the podcast because that helps others get this fed into their feed. So today I've got Aaron, who's a diving connection colleague from California. Aaron, tell us about yourself, who you are, what do you do, how did you get to where you are, and where people can find you virtually and in the real world?
Yeah, so my name is Aaron Potash. I'm based in Oakland, California. I'm a now instructor for since 1998, been teaching scuba diving in California in the nice cold waters of Monterey, California. I'm also a division safety coordinator at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. I've been in the safety field for over a decade, having transitioned from being still, I'm still a licensed paramedic in California, but I've been transitioned from the response side to actually the prevention side of things. Particularly interested in human organizational performance and a lot of the stuff that Gareth has been talking about in the diving connection, in the diving world, I've been able to transfer over into my work world.
That's really cool. And I love the fact that what I've done is I've taken stuff from high-risk industries, repackaged it into diving, and then divers who work in high-risk industries go, hey, we can use this and we can bring it back into our own space, which I think is really cool. And where can people find you? Oh, yeah. Because, you know, people are people. It's just the stories that change. So where can we find you?
Yeah, I'm at originaloaktowndivers, .com. On the web, you can find me on Instagram at Original Oaktown Divers as well.
We'll stick those in the show notes. Now, this show's all about storytelling. And what's the first story that you've got to tell that we can get across, and then we'll dig into the detail as part of that second story?
Yeah, so this is kind of it's a tough story for me. But I figured it's very appropriate to share this. So, in August of 23, I was in Monterey teaching a scuba class, I had three students. My wife was also down there hanging out with us, and, my youngest daughter and one of my students' kids was there as well, who just finished the junior lifeguard stuff. But, we're on the breakwater, which is, at San Carlos Beach, and it's probably one of the top destinations for learning to dive in California. It's a very well-known location. And if you can imagine, it's this long breakwater wall, very long wall with the first half of it. It has a parking structure where most of us divers would park and stage. And then we'd walk down into the beach, which is adjacent to the breakwater. Further down the breakwater is a fishing area where most of the fishermen folks would go. And so this was the first day of this open water class, where I was going to do, three dives, one free diving thing, cause we do a lot of free diving in the NAWI courses. And then a second and a third scuba diving. We geared up in the morning and went free diving. We had about less than 10 feet of visibility, which is a little bit low for Monterey, but it's a great training day. We had a good bit of swell. And a little bit of surge. So it wasn't a tough entry, but there were, you know, it was great training conditions. And went off for a dive and everybody had fun and we decided to go for our scuba dive. For that scuba dive, we went out in the water. We did all of our skills for that first dive and we came back. And, you know, you wait as scuba divers, you wait in between dives and we call it our surface interval time. Well, we're gearing up for now our third dive. And we were having our briefing about the skills that we're going to cover and the site that we're going to visit at Breakwater to see, you know, to talk about location because we're slightly different location. And a woman comes up to me and she said, "Hey, somebody needs some help on the beach. Can you help?" And I look out in the water. I'm standing on the breakwater. And I don't see anything out of the ordinary, but I figure, okay, yeah, I guess I'll help. And so I walk down. I'm not in a hurry because I don't know what's going on. And I zip up my dry suit as I'm walking in case I need to get in the water. And as I get on the beach, I see somebody else running down the beach. There's nobody else on the beach at this time. And I'm looking out on the water, and all I see are a whole bunch of instructors out there, a bunch of classes that are going out there. They're instructor floats. But I do see somebody being pushed in the water, and that person's being pushed in a tired diver tow, which the fins are up on the person's shoulders and getting pushed into the beach. And so I walk down the water, and I decide to help, and thinking I'm going to help lift this person and get them out. They don't have any gear on, so I reach down in the water and realize that this person is blue. And all of a sudden, that paramedic brain of mine kicks in, and I lift this person up, drag him on the beach, and we start compressions immediately on this person. The compressions went on for a good couple minutes, and fortunately, Coast Guard was very quick to respond. After this, I disappeared into the crowd. I mean, I've done this for many, many years, and I didn't want to be there more than I had to. And I disappeared in the crowd, and I got back to my students and my family, and we talked about this, and we considered going for our third dive, but they ended up pronouncing the person on the beach, and they actually left the body on the beach that day until the coroner's office could show up. After that, we went back to the campsite because we like camping and diving. We had lots of s'mores after having a nice hearty meal at our favorite restaurant at Phil's Fish House, and we sat by the campfire and just decompressed to regroup the next day. It ended up not being able to finish that class because we missed one of our dives that weekend. And I owed the team a dive, which we later followed up several months later and had an amazing dive at my favorite beach, Monastery Beach. An epic dive. And it was a beautiful end for that for our class.
So just, you know, what you've explained, that story is often the real sort of limited detail that we get in the diving industry, and that doesn't help us learn. So what's the second story? What did you find out, and you know, what can we learn from this?
Yeah, well, there were a lot of things that transpired, and I 100% agree that this first story is usually all we get when we read the article or the newspaper clipping about what happened. I was, you know, we were all shell-shocked that day on the beach and at the breakwater. There were a lot of people there. There were a lot of witnesses for this event, and we heard lots of stories. You know, so some of the things that we learned on the beach is that this was the very first time this person had entered the water after their pool sessions. It was their very first dive, and this occurred in 4 feet of water at the first time they had dropped down. Other stories we had heard and that this person had been very, very scared, very nervous of the dives. And it was interesting because somebody had pinged it as me as one of the people providing CPR. And I received a phone call one day from a background investigator from the family. And the background investigator had informed me, a lot of other things that had happened, regarding, the autopsy. It came out as drowning, and I had asked about, well, you know, most of us were thinking it might have been a heart attack or a stroke. Nothing wrong with the heart was the response I got back. And then there was more information that was provided by the investigator. It said that on the swim out, the person had been coughing and hacking. And I was asked, is it common that a diver could be choking or choking on water as they were swimming out? And that immediately brought to mind, wow, you know, this is kind of sounding a lot like an immersion pulmonary edema type of thing.
My first thought just there as well, actually.
We don't normally talk about immersion pulmonary edema, and the only reason I knew about it is because I read about a diving fatality that happened in the UK in a quarry a couple years prior, but that's never been part of my training or anything else like that. As a result of that, emergent pulmonary edema, whether this was a case or not, has been one of my big things of interest as a scuba instructor. I do teach the Diving Alert Network first aid and CPR mm-hmm. and diving first aid pro course. And I do speak a lot on emergent pulmonary edema because I recognize it as a major issue within the diving community and snorkeling community and swimming community as well.
It's one of those things that probably over the last 10 years has sort of picked up interest, more so in the UK, sort of going further afield because of a medic in the UK called Peter Wilmhurst, who's done a lot of research on this. Do you want to give us a quick sort of lowdown on what it is? Because I would pretty much guarantee that most people don't know what it means.
Yeah, so IPE is basically, it's pulmonary edema. You're basically flash flooding your lungs with fluid coming from your bloodstream into your lungs. And what we see is that anytime you get into body water, what you're doing is you're exerting a pressure onto your vasculature system, which is forcing the water out into your lungs. Normally, albumin, as I understand it, holds that water back in place. But just by being in the water, when we have certain variables that are in addition to being in the water, we can actually change that the pressure slightly so that the water gets out into our lungs. And then the treatment really is get them out of the water as quickly as possible. We're starting to see things like the way that a regulator would breathe or even rebreather could actually change the pressures in our blood system that could create conditions where emergent pulmonary edema would be more common. If we a good breather, something that gives you good air, but also gives you a little bit of resistance coming out, exhalation actually does it decrease the likelihood of emergent pulmonary edema. It's kind of like CPAP, the way CPAP would work.
Now, that's a really interesting piece about the physiology that's there. And this is an unknown variable. And the challenge, the real challenge for divers is that when it comes on, there's not a lot you can do about it. So it's about getting out of the water, as you say. Now, if you've got a decompression head overhead, pretty stuffed at that stage. And the other complicating factor, or even if you've got a physical overhead, like in a cave or in a wreck, then we've got challenges there. And the other thing is that it's difficult, as I understand, to detect unless it's picked up in the post-mortem straight away, because the fluid will dissipate. And so we don't know. And we end up with these sort of unexplained deaths. And it's an interesting piece about where research is and what's important to a community. The area that I'm really interested in is about human factors and checklists and peer pressure and all of these factors, which are really difficult to nail down. And my personal view is that some of the physiological stuff is, we'll focus on that because it's easy, it's not contentious, and we can measure it or we can do something about it. But in terms of the bigger safety picture, then actually there's many more things that I believe we could do to improve safety, because we've got to come up and out. And I think part of that focus in the diving space is because most of the safety research is done through the medical community, and that's what they know. Whereas actually trying to get other interest is a bit harder. So what are the thoughts amongst your diving community about IPE, and what did people learn from that event? So it's not just the prevention piece, but also, what else came out about the sort of detection and recovery, because ultimately we're trying to, develop resilient systems. So we can predict this, we can monitor the system. What are we going to adapt, and then how do we learn?
So a lot of us are, there's some of us that speak about this incident that have certain knowledge about it. But one of the things, that changed the way that I did business and the way that I do things in general, is that, my goal is by the time we get to the water, I've got somebody that's really excited about being there. And if we're not in that space, we're not ready for the ocean. Because I want to really increase that level of, yes, they're going to be nervous. But I also, I realize this is an interesting space. We have somebody who's never had this experience before. So yes, they're going to be nervous. How much does the scuba instructor then push that person?
It's totally.
A very interesting space. And so I really try to preload, my courses and even in my safety trainings and stuff like that I do at work with that type of experience. Like, this is the first time we're doing this. Let's have fun with this and explore this and get ahead of these butterflies in our stomach. Right. So that's one thing I did. The other thing that I've done for myself is, for my own diving business, I have made it so that I'm very upfront about pricing so that we can take away that burden of, oh, I'm going to miss this day or I need to cancel. I want to make sure that people are free to feel that, all right, this is not a barrier. And if you read reviews and stuff like that, people talk about my flexibility, because I need that to be present, because I need a diver to understand I'm just not feeling this. And we talk about thumbing a dive, but that's a really hard thing to do when you got all that pressure. And so I realized that I really try to front load it with this is all right.
Yeah.
And so one of the ways I did that was actually with the pricing structure. But there's so much within this, in this event. One of the things that reasons we go to breakwater is because we, as scuba instructors, we talk about that we have all of this help that's available for us. We have the Coast Guard right there. We have Monterey Fire, which is really close by. We have all these dive instructors. We have all these people on the beach. But when this incident happened, it was a popular day out there. And this person was being swum in past all of these scuba students and scuba classes. It was silent. Now, this is from my perspective, of course, right? I didn't see anybody else on the beach. It was me and this other person. And granted, maybe I'm in that frame of mind of this is the world and everything's kind of collapsing amongst it. But it happened. This event happened in silence from what I could tell. And when I started looking at that, I realized, wait a minute, we talk about all these rescue classes and help, help. And in fact, we say in rescue class instead of saying
pizza,
help,
pizza.
What does that do? Is that really what it played out to be? And this dive instructor that ended up pushing this person had to make determinations out there. Determination, as I understand it after the event, was that where he was calling for help was exposed to further down the breakwater wall where you weren't going to have those divers. You had the fisher people, which is why none of the divers had heard this from the shore. And we didn't see it from the shore. And so when they got closer through the other groups, there may not have been that knowledge that that's going on. And then this person's being, there's a fin push, a tired diver toe on this, which is a normal event for any type of training day out there. And so it's kind
and
of
you're, in your head, sort of from what I can get, remember it's head down. And so actually you're driving it and you're going to have a reg in your mouth. Regulator in your mouth, so it's not like you're going to be able to shout for those people. So
no, and it was a heck of a swim that this person did too. It was a really long swim, and I remember the person when he got out of the water was exhausted, and I would have been as well. But this happened in silence, in relative silence. Certainly, people knew, and obviously somebody had alerted me to this issue as well.
Yeah. How much of that is about fear of litigation and bystander effect? From my sort of sitting on this side of the pond, I believe California is way up there when it comes to sort of throwing people under the bus for that sort of stuff. So how does that work in a rescue? I mean, you've got the professional mindset that goes, I'm going to do this, and it switches. But what's it like for real for sort of lay people to be in that situation?
I don't know if that came into play. I mean, what I saw from this instructor was, it was when I sit back and I analyze it from this nice comfy captain chair that I have, I see it is this person made some decisions and determinations in the field to get this person into the beach as quickly as possible. And I can't take that away from them at all.
Absolutely.
And so I don't know what that, I don't know what was in their mind, but I also don't know what was in the mind of the scuba instructors that this person swam past. I don't know if they would have even seen this. Was it a bystander effect? Maybe, but from my vantage point, it didn't.
You may not even notice it. So there's another piece you picked up there, which was about the amount of effort required to do a rescue and a recovery. So a number of years ago in the UK, there were two instructors, and I don't know whether or not you've seen this video. So there's Mark Powell and Tim Clements, both UK-based technical instructors, and they decided to do a training serial where they rescued somebody from about 20 meters, so about 70 feet down. And what they did is they got the subject, they hooked up the heart rate monitor, they had a camera, and they basically synced all the data afterwards. And the scenario was, you lift them from the bottom, you get them on the surface tow of maybe only 30 or 40 meters. It wasn't very far. And then you've got to get them on the quay side of the quarry. And then they basically transferred over to a Resusci Annie to go and do CPR for what would be the sort of likely time period before the paramedics would arrive. And then they put the video online with the heart rate monitor trace, and they went, oh my God, that probably wasn't a safe thing to do in terms of a training scenario, because the heart rates were up at sort of 145, 150, 155, these guys. And he's thinking, this guy was pretty fit. And you sit there and go, how fit are the majority of instructors who are able to effect a rescue, just, to do the long swim and then bring them onto the shore side? Because trying to do any form of in-water rescue, Beth, is not really worth doing it. We talk about doing this, but in reality, the research, the papers even written said, unless you can get something done really quickly, it's a case of get them on the beach and get stuff going. Otherwise, it's a non-starter.
So I'm glad you hit on that, especially the rescue breath side, because that was another conversation that came out of this. When I pulled this person out, it was clear to me that rescue breaths had been started because there's essentially emesis on the face. It looked like ventilation had not been successful from what I could tell. So that's from the paramedic mind that's speaking. And that was one of the things that stood out. And that really kind of drew, that started a conversation for me in my rescue class. And even in Now We Open Water, we actually teach rescue breathing. We do a lot of training in NAWI courses, which is really kind of cool. It got me thinking about what these rescue breaths are and how effective are they? And I started doing some research on the Undersea Hyperbaric Association, when to do rescue breaths versus when to kind of go
hell for leather and get somebody on the shore so you can do CPR and then the rescue breaths.
Yeah. And then I started thinking about, some of the ways that we teach rescue breathing and realizing that it's almost like this pizza thing, right? Are we actually doing any good when we're doing this? Because what we're doing is we're turning somebody's head slightly in the water, and then we're blowing across their face, over a course of 3 seconds, right? But we're not really simulating. We don't have any mannequins that can really drive that for the conversation to actually train rescue breathing. And so I don't know how effective that is. And I'd be really curious to get some better understanding of that, or to have some sort of simulation aid. I mean, you mentioned we as paramedics and even when I teach a first aid CPR class, we're using these mannequins. And I guess we could bring it in the water, but we have to float it, right? Because now all of a sudden you're potentially on top of this person and putting their head under the water.
Well, and actually that, that's the bit about research is trying to find these. And this discussion about Resusci Annies reminded me of Jonathan Langham, who's one of the other human diver instructors based down at Georgia Aquarium. They recently procured silicon breasts for their mannequins so that they can actually get the staff used to giving CPR to women with breasts as opposed to flat resusciannies and how to deal with this. And there were some interesting discussions about don't make the breasts too big. It's like, look, you know, that might be the harder thing to do. You know, are men likely to do CPR on a woman when they're there and you've got to take, you know, clothes off and you sit there going, this is difficult. So it's an interesting bit of how we make the decisions and how it makes sense for us to do what we do at that time. And whether or not delaying getting people out the water increases the likelihood of a fatality because we're doing that. And then what's the guilt aspect of the rescuer? You know, do they have this, like, could I have done something different? And, you know, a colleague of mine in the UK, a lady called Laura Walton, does a lot of stuff on trauma. And often this question is, could I have done more? And whenever I speak to people about this is, you did what you could in the moment with what you've got. That's it. There's nothing else. Because if there was something else you could have done, and it would have come to mind, you would have done it. You don't sit there in the heat of the moment and go, good idea, I'm going to dismiss that. We do what we can in that moment. And it is about exploring boundaries in the training environment to make it as realistic as possible so you've got more tools. But at the same time, you know, the diving space, it's marketed as a safe, sexy, accessible sport that anybody can do. And so we don't want to bring out this inherent hazard that sits out there and says, you know what, you're in a non-life-sustaining environment out there. And that's a tension between marketing and safety. And the training departments and the marketing departments, the training departments often want to do more, but the marketing departments say, if we do more, we lose business. So it's really cool to hear about your business model. You turn around and go, this is what we do.
Yeah. And I use this term front loading a lot. You know, I'm open and honest about this conversation that occurred about this event. My open water students from the very get-go understand that this is the realm that they're getting into. And we have open conversations about these challenges. And I have, you know, my scuba group that I have on WhatsApp, we communicate about these events and I provide insight where I can and questions where I can. But I really want to foster that type of conversation because I agree, it doesn't really exist within our scuba community. And you know, my realm, my full-time job is really about risk management, right? And really talking about what are the hazards, what are the things that we're facing, and being an open and honest about these conversations and without, you know, without hiding things. You know, I view it as incredibly important. And, you know, the training that I develop and the procedures that I help write, they're all geared for having this honest conversation about what does work actually look like, not what we want it to look like.
Yeah, totally.
What does it mean to do this job? What do I need to do this job? And so when I translate that to my scuba business and my scuba world, it's what do I need you to do to become more adaptable to the conditions that you're about to face? It's not a rule that's going to get you through this. It is your ability to recognize when to change your course heading, so to speak, rapidly. So expert decision-making model really comes into my scuba classes. I need people to be able to adapt to changing conditions and to things that they may not necessarily understand.
So some posts recently about social media and every risk we do, every risk we face has got a reward element associated with it. And that's the big challenge we have in diving is that we are in a sport. We're in something where we're getting rewards. We want to go in the underwater environment. We want to explore these settings. And so it's not just the loss, which could be the injury, the fatality, getting entangled, running out of gas, all of the negative side. And we talk about risk management. But the risk management that's often talked about in the diving industry is about liability, not operational risk management. And if we're going to do operational loss management, we also have to understand what the motivation space is for people to go and do that. And you talked about sorting out the financial aspects and sitting there and go, right, we're going to, time isn't an issue. Money isn't an issue. This is what the course costs. This is how long it will take. And we've got some extra bits that are there, because those are drivers for error producing conditions where we might be running out of money. We might run out of time. We've got a holiday booked. We've got to get this stuff done. Can't you just give me the card? So the risk element of what we're dealing with is we have to look at the positive sides of that. So what do you do as a diving instructor and a hot practitioner to look at the positive side of behaviors that might shape wrong outcomes or bad outcomes?
Well, and I'm really interested in that conversation about what costs are, what the complexity is for the world of the worker, right? I mean, anytime we say, okay, well, we often, in many industries, we talk about things like stop work authority, right? You have the ability to stop work. But in the reality of everyday work, once we stop that work, you may lose funding for a project and then people are getting laid off, right?
Yeah.
So if we're going to have this type of stop work authority in whatever realm we are, or the ability to speak up in a diving type of activity, we need to also be fully aware that this comes with a consequence. And so front load our work with buffers that protect against that as possible. And that's part of the reason why I've changed the way that I structure my classes as far as cost goes. You know, and in the diving industry, where it seems to be cheaper, faster, and quote unquote better. Everybody, I'm competing with a lot of shops and a lot of other organizations that, you know, they put out Groupons or, you know, discounts for scuba classes. And I can't compete at that level because time is something that's important to me. I have a family and I do have a full-time job and I enjoy every part of life, right?
Yeah, totally.
And I love teaching scuba, but I can't do that for free. I do want to, you know, I do need to ensure that that I'm able to recover some costs, but I also want to ensure that that's completely conveyed to the people that I'm working with, so that they can then they can feel better about extending out their hours. So really realizing in any type of activity that we're doing, that, you know, that the costs associated with something, that the time exposure is a big factor in the way we do safety. And however we can get that conveyed in a course, I think is very important. And in work in general.
And I think one of the big challenges as well, as in the same in the corporate space, is those who are decision makers, policy writers, budget approvers, often are really separated from the messiness of work. So you go and speak to the training agencies and they go, this is how it works. And you go, when was the last time you actually saw what was going on, what you really saw, as opposed to the world smells of fresh paint? As you know, right. when an audit happens, it's all as it's supposed to be. But actually understanding the pressures that diving instructors have got, DMs have got, shops have got, or in the case of the workspace, is what those frontline operators, frontline supervisors have got to balance and trade to manage that as best they can. And often the absence of an adverse event is the inference that it's safe because everything is going well. But we've got no idea how much of the margin is being eroded.
Oh, 100%. And one of the things that I really strive for is empathy. I know there's been a lot of talk recently about empathy, but I think empathy is one of our, you know, when we can develop the ability to be empathic, it's one of our strongest skills, because it puts you in the frame of the people that are doing the work, or of the dive instructor, or the dive shop, or of the scuba student. And allows you to understand things from their context and the challenges. And that's really, you know, we try to build trust in any of these courses or any of the things that I do, but really part of what I'm going for is empathy, to really understand the world of the people that I'm working with.
Right. The final bit was, what's your big takeaway from diving that you've managed to apply into your workspace?
Big takeaway for me. You know, one of the things that is my son, went to college, this year. He's a freshman. And, I told him, if he can help me with my classes, and my scuba business, then he can get more money for, college. And, he finally contributed big, and he's now my video person.
Cool.
He's made one video, on expert decision making. And really, I think what it comes down to is how do we increase the level of the ability to be better decision makers? And I use this type of concept in both scuba diving, and in my work world as well. And one of the things that I really talk about to all my students and not to all the people I work with is our training, right? And it's so much more than just training people to follow the rule or follow the requirement or compliance based. What I'm really going for is how do we create more realistic training,
more real simulation patterns to match against, so that
more real patterns, yes, because that is what helps us navigate the volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous world of work and scuba diving.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And it's that piece of, if we don't have things going wrong and people are allegedly following the rules, then the rules must be what's keeping people safe. But actually, it's not. It's their expertise, their competence, their pattern matching that's going on. There's a bit of luck involved, absolutely. But when you've got lots of experience, you can share those stories. And that's really what this podcast is about, is getting those context-rich stories out there to get people to think differently about an event. And the fact that we're talking about diving and, you know, high-risk industries in the same conversation is because we have people who are dealing with, as you said, the VUCA world that's there, that it's not linear, it's not simple, it doesn't have simple cause and effect. We have to learn from those things. So great conversation, Aaron. What would be your sort of book, article, video that you would recommend other people read or consume that sort of influenced your view of the world? Something old, something more recent?
Yeah. So you happen to have had this person on recently. Jesse Singer's book, There Are No Accidents, was groundbreaking, earth-shattering, and I don't want to use the term manifesto, but I'm going to use it. It really described what many of us are trying to do, both in the diving world and in the high risk industry and research and development and complex industry world, in terms of safety, describe, you know, the system is there, and how do people have to navigate that system? And when we put the focus on the person to navigate it, we're going to have problems and challenges that arise and unexpected outcomes or unwanted outcomes.
Yeah, yeah.
And that the focus is that the system is the thing that needs to be looked at. And Jesse Singer's work was amazing in this, and I highly recommend that book. And I'd say that for anybody in the safety industry or scuba industry, I think it's a phenomenal book.
I totally agree. And I think one of the hardest bits about it is you sit there and you might feel absolutely helpless when you read this and you realize the enormity of the problem. But at the same time, you know, I've started the movement in the diving space of trying to bring human factors in. A friend of mine who you might know, Guy Shockey, he's one of the instructors, he said, you know, every rainstorm starts with a single raindrop. And for those who don't get it in the States, is every blizzard starts with a snowflake. And it's that bit of, actually, if we get that change, then we can start to create things. But we've got to recognize that what we're doing at the moment only gets you so far. We have to look up and out. And that's really hard, because a lot of the time it's outside of our control. It might be in our influence, but it's certainly in our interest in what we're trying to do. So, Aaron, thank you very much for your time, and I hope to catch up with you soon.